remember after one of our Quijote performances of hiding behind a shrub in a pasture and watching the audience and seeing them at the end of a performance look around and see that they were next to someone they didn't know and that they had been on this journey. And they didn't even quite know where they were because they had traveled around this farm. And this deep sense of joy. What my observation was in seeing this was, oh, this is, there's a deep craving for this.
This is Frontiers of Commoning with David Bollier.
I'm with Matthew Glassman and Carlos Oriona of Double Edge Theater, the co-artistic directors. And we're talking today about how they came to see the commons and how they're doing pioneering work in exploring the importance of commons to artistic work and cultural organizations, performance, and many other aspects of art today. Welcome, both of you. Let's start with you telling us a little bit about Double Edge Theater. You're a very unusual theater troupe. Tell us a bit of your history and what your mission is today, Matthew.
Double Edge Theater is almost a 37-year-old ensemble theater. Carlos and I are only two members of a larger leadership of directors, including our founder and artistic director, Stacy Klein, as well as co-artistic director Jennifer Johnson and producing director Adam Bright. So we're two parts of a multi-headed leadership of a larger ensemble. Double Edge started by Stacy in 1982 in Boston. At the beginning, it was a, would you say, a feminist collective?
I would say.
Yeah.
Yep.
And began creating original work that in the beginning was all women and then became women and men and others in Boston. By 1994, let's say the early 90s, it became too expensive for a long-term ensemble. We call ourselves a laboratory theater to exist in Boston. So we began a process of moving out to rural Western Massachusetts. Today, we occupy and operate on a 100-acre former dairy farm where we create our work, we run our organization, and we interact with our community. And I should have said this first, but Double Edge makes art in the form of live theater. Our type of live theater, as you said in the beginning, is unusual in that it really privileges the imagination. Flight, our work is imagistic and visceral and invites the spectator into something that is way beyond what we would say psychology and written work.
Well, let me interrupt here and just try to give the listener a sense of what you're talking about. Because, first of all, we're sitting here on beautiful farmland near a hillside in the town of Ashfield, Massachusetts, a very small town. And Double Edge doesn't have a normal theater venue the way most theater troupes do. You use your farm itself as a venue, and many of your performances are outside with, as you mentioned, aerial performances and people in trees and other unusual things. So give a little, tell me a little bit more about the nature of your performances and how you're not simply doing scripted plays the way many performers do.
First of all, we make two different types of performances. We make indoor performances, which we, as you said, we create and perform in our barn, old 18th century slate roof, former hay barn. 30 by 60, and that's the where we do our artistic research, and then we share that research with our community, and we tour those indoor performances around the country and around the world. And in addition to that, beginning about 17 years ago, in 2002, we started doing indoor-outdoor traveling spectacles. As you mentioned, performances that happen outdoors, they travel around, the audience moves in procession, actors fly out of trees. The complete vista of the environment and nature, and the sights and sounds, the stars, the wind, the water, the pastures are all part of that work. And they're larger than life, and they have all sorts of important components that are about a really a group experience, sort of an ancient communal experience of the imagination and of story. And now we not only do that here at our farm in the summer, but in the fall and in other communities, both urban and rural.
Once we were visited, well, many times we were visited by Richard Schechner, who's a studious of theater anthropology. He said that our theater is archaic, not ancient. And everybody laughed. It was like a lecture. And he said, no, wait, wait. What I mean by archaic is that it's connected to the origins of theater in the sense of the old Greek etymology of the word, anarchy. And I think that some of these moments or events inside of our performance, like Matthew was describing, somehow brings us back to that origin, where the borders get blurred between the audience and the... Matthew says that at the end of every summer show, or at least for a year now, he's been saying the borders between the landscape and the... and between the audience and the performers get blurred.
I can say as a visitor to one of your performances, or several of your performances, it's quite transforming to be right by a creek that the performer is wading through, or to see the stars on a hot summer night, and to feel almost enacted these mythopoetic deep things, which no Ibsen or Shakespeare even can quite convey if you're simply within a building. So there is a very different elemental feel to the performances you've made.
I think that reconnecting to the natural world and our imagination and our mythic imagination in that context of the full expanse of the sky and is really important to how we evolve. And I think I learned over the years of being a part of this and watching how especially Stacy and Carlos were finding this work, because it came out of a lot of research here in its early years, that because sometimes as an actor in these works, if you're not in a scene, you're likely hiding behind a bush or half in a pond behind a rock or up in a tree, because that fluidity and seamlessness is so important to the experience of the spectator. And that gives you an opportunity. I remember after one of our Quixote performances of hiding behind a shrub in a pasture and watching the audience and seeing them at the end of a performance look around and see that they were next to someone they didn't know and that they had been on this journey and they didn't even quite know where they were because they had traveled around this farm, and this deep sense of joy, this sort of awakening back to the reality that they had left but had sort of gone deeper into at the same time. And what my observation was in seeing this was, oh, there's a deep craving for this. There's a deep, deep craving for this experience, this specific and special type of experience that this nourishes and touches.
It's very immersive without being, and now we're going to knock down the fourth wall. It's like you enter into it and the fourth wall is not there. But let me transition to the commons. This podcast is about the frontiers of commoning, and I'm very curious how you folks came to see the commons as relevant to your artistic endeavors and indeed to a larger community of artists nationwide.
I mean, when you mention you, David, or anybody, as soon as you utter the word commons, you're already bringing forth an articulation and a thought that is not common. That's not something people talk about. I was lucky enough that I had training when I was young in the commons. So I was seeing it. I was invited to a party in Argentina and I met this woman that gave me a book. She's turning 80 now, so I went to her 80th birthday and she gave me a book that was 365 Days of Self-Management. And that's the story of the workers of the National Electrical Company in Argentina taking over the factory. It's a Peronist group, and they self-managed for a year, and it was perfect.
That's a very famous episode. Series. I've heard of the Argentinians around the country doing that. It was a very famous episode of history.
It was finished by a coup d'etat. Juan José Tacona was the leader, but there were many, many people involved in that. And I was probably 18 when I got that book, and I thought, this could be a way for my life that I could do anything like this. And so every project that I started, I was not really comfortable with a common theater. I love doing theater, but I didn't want to do it, and I wanted to be an owner of my work. Years goes by, I do all these experiences, I've been in many collectives, and then I crossed paths in 1996 Double Edge, and my first thought was, well, you're not talking about this, but you're a common.
And when you say a collective, tell me a little bit more about a collective, because people often have different images of that, and a co-op or so forth. What did it mean in terms of an artistic collective?
In this case, what I saw was an atypical collective. They didn't have assemblies, they didn't have, but it worked more like what I would say a family. The fact that everybody, in one way or another, was owning what was being done.
And how did that affect the kind of art and performances that resulted?
I think that I believe in immersive experiences. I was a sport player, a collective sports, mostly soccer, football, like we call it, but I did others like that. And I believe in the immersion, both of the audience and the players. I believe in those phenomena. I also always believed in rock and roll. That was my thing when I was young. So, and Mardi Gras. That's the other thing that I was involved. So these are experiences that where everybody is inside of something. I think that the best possible way to organize something like that is through a commons of any kind.
Because it allowed greater freedom of expression to do that? It surfaced things that otherwise couldn't be surfaced?
No, it's not about freedom of expression. I think you can have freedom of expression in a different, so more in the individualistic way. But I think what it does is it makes everybody in. Everybody's in. Everybody. It's a question of faith that is not attached. I don't want to compare it to the faith of religion, although it has a connection, of course. But it's a question of believing in what you're doing. So that narrative that is happening at that time, at that moment, everybody believes together. So it is a religious experience.
As somebody who's witnessed and been part of your performances, I agree that's a very distinguishing element, is there's this a level of group commitment that is quite palpable and powerful.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, the question about how the sense of collective plays out in our performances or in our aesthetics. And it's really important with that question in mind, go back to the source, let's say, what is the source of our work? And the source of our work, in our words, here is what we would call training.
Tell me what that's all about.
Well, training for us is many things, but let's say it is predicated or rests on the idea of the human potential, of exploding the potential of the actor or of the artist as a creator, as an autonomous creator. Mm. That's an important distinction. In traditional Western theater, the actor is an interpreter. And in traditional Western theater, in the last 100 years or so, that the actor is an interpreter of the words of a playwright, and usually within a system of organization that's hierarchical, that begins with producing and the needs of the market and the bringing in of a director who has a vision and the words of the playwright and the vision of the playwright. And in this work, our work is cross-disciplinary. It is very collaborative and it's ensemble-based. We are a group. And we're a laboratory group. So we are researching our potential through training. And that training is a physical training where we work with the exploding the potential of our bodies, working with the limits of our individual physical limits. We try to achieve flight physically. It's not aerial technique. It's different forms of being able to fly, to achieve heightened levels of energy in order to create and to be very present. This is a training to become present and to go beyond ourselves. So there's intellectual component to our training where we are reading and sharing. There is a physical component where we're working with forms and exercises as well as, but much more beyond form, to go way beyond ourselves and to tap higher levels of presence and consciousness in that process. It's also musical, and it's vocal, and it's writerly, and it is also image-based and design-based. And sometimes it's also about invention and engineering and animating things that might seem to have very little value.
So this is not like a matter of technique the way many actor schools approach acting. It's about really the whole person and their expressive capacities.
Exactly, and that's very important. Precision is very important to us. Technique might be a part of a process towards actualizing what we imagine, but it's not about form and it's not about virtuosity. It's about exploding those forms through something more.
Performers realize that there is a deeper connection to what they're doing. The other important thing is that when you see a performance, we're not representing, we are creating on the spot, although what you're seeing is blocked and rehearsed, with precision, the actor is creating at that time.
Let's just, so the listeners can understand some of these general descriptions, tell me about two or three of your performances in the summers, especially outdoors, what they were about, what they were trying to convey. I know you, for example, had the local festival with the town that was on the town common, and you've had other events here on the farm. Describe what they were, quote, about.
I think they have a certain universality to them and accessibility, which is, the first is an adaptation of Don Quixote we did many years ago, many, many years ago. And in that performance, what you might see is, instead of the windmills as being giant staircases in a pasture with people with giant flags and this sort of this feeling of largeness and scope outside, you'll see Quixote and Sancho wandering into a pond. You'll see Don Quixote in the caves of Montesinos, which is a very spiritual part of the book where he is sort of encountering God in this place. You'll see Quixote wandering into a pond where there's fires around him at different levels, books floating illuminated by candles. You'll see Quixote running in through a doorway into a pasture, into a tunnel of light. You'll see Sancho actually in a chicken coop with real chickens. And you'll also see an army of musicians with violins and trombones and cello. This was one of our very first ones, but it's very important to mention because this is a circular conversation. There's many points that are swirling around each other constantly when we're talking about how and why we're a collective and how that plays out in performance and what makes it a commons and the individual. And we haven't talked about the community yet. But Quixote was important for us here. And I know you're asking me to describe what the show looks like, but I have to talk about this in any case. Because it was the first time we used a universal archetype in our work as the method of storytelling with our aesthetic in a way that our rural audience could see themselves through this archetype of someone who dreams, basically. And that identification with that archetype created an identification of what we were doing here, which again goes back to our training, which goes back to trying to surpass yourself, trying to have vision and enact those visions. That's what the artist is trying to do. And these summer spectacles become a way of bringing that to true life, that true experience of mythology and archetype that includes flight and includes the natural world and includes the imagination is experienced by the spectator, by the community, and felt. And thus we end up living in that place in our daily life in some ways where the survival becomes shared as well.
So in a way, would it be fair to say you couldn't do what you do without having this farm, or even more broadly, living in the small town of Ashfield as your context for your own imagination and your own engagement?
I think there are things that are not so planned, that it's more like you find them and they find you. When we moved here, we were thinking, we were an urban theater trying to do all these kind of stuff. It's very difficult to do this in an urban environment.
Mm-hmm.
Not because of the landscape, but because of the distractions and the demands. We learned how to use this land for our purposes, to tell these stories. We're telling our own story in a concealed way. So when we're talking about Quixote, we're talking about some kind of impulse that we have that is Quixotic. Like just to come and decide to move away, move from Buenos Aires, they moved from Boston. We all came from different places. Matthew moved from Boston and then Hartford here. Instead of choosing to go to New York or other places, we chose this. And then we started finding here how everything could be part of the aesthetics, including a community that doesn't necessarily rehearse with us or train with us necessarily, but they are part of this. They are engaged, and they're more and more engaged.
How is the community engaged with the theater and your performances?
It really depends on the project we're doing, but the engagement of the local culture can range from a host of tradespeople participating in the building and design of something, and a local excavator using his truck to go to a place an hour and a half away to bring an old ship for our version of the Odyssey so we could have a wreckage. It includes local stonemasons who build large stone towers for beautiful medieval stone towers called cairns for different performances. It is local visual artists who create mosaics or who create sculptures of fabrics. And in something like the town spectacle, we're looking at mythology through a different lens. We're looking at the mythology of the place where we live, the history of free thought, the stories, the identity of the place, and the sense of meaning and purpose of the place, where we then, the partners and the collaborators, were hundreds of people from the historical society who helped in that research to local musicians and writers and poets to young people, and really a host of people that were stilting and parading and playing music in a deeply artistic and collective way.
We also found that there are a lot of our neighbors and a lot of the families that are somehow founding families of this town, they had a lot of characters in their families that were unbelievable. So we asked them to tell about them. And then we started finding a lot of common threads of thinking. The person that built the house where we're recording in 1790 was a free thinker, a member of the Liberty Party.
He was an abolitionist.
Abolition.
He was a farmer, he was a peppermint farmer, who would go on the road peddling herbs and oils, and at the same time he was disseminating the Liberator, which was
the abolitionist newspaper. I'm just struck by your descriptions of how essentially double-edged theater is commenting on multiple dimensions at once, as an artistic community, as an organization, as people engaging with the town, your inspirations from the landscape, and even the intergenerational connections.
Right, and I think that there's two components to our mission as an organization. One is to create the best art possible. Really, it goes as far as it possibly can through the collective research of the group. And again, if you go back to Quixote, as a metaphor, the training for us is that idea of potential and of flight. You could think about it in mystical terms and esoteric terms. Sancho Quixote can fly because Sancho anchors him at times, and other times Sancho flies because Quixote anchors him. And our training is that sort of collective sort of anchoring and flying and protection of space to go somewhere.
Yet being organizationally functional and solvent.
Because that's the thing, this is all living on a continuum of an artistic search and a relationship to survival, not only of our own survival, but the survival of our ecosystem. So that's the one part of our mission is the art, and the second part of our mission is creating a living culture. And that living culture comes about through the interaction of this artistic research for all of its esoteria, as well as its practicalities, that interaction between the artist collective and the community and place where it is. And that ends up playing out in all these ways.
Now, you mentioned survival. It reminds me of your biannual workshops or gatherings called Art and Survival, in which you gather numerous people from different non-commercial, regional, and other theater and culture groups from around the U.S., Tell me about why you started that and why you even joined the terms art and survival.
It's one of many things that Double Edge is working on these days under a larger vision of what we're calling art justice. That's looking at how living culture is interacting with the greater world in all of its facets, not only particular traditional ones of performance and pedagogy, let's say. But art and survival is inspired by what I learned from when I came here from my mentors, who are Stacy Klein, the founder and artistic director, and Carlos, who's sitting next to me, which was, how do you work on that connection between what you search for in training, which for us, as was described to me in these early years, as being sort of capital W work. That's the reason. That's the reason to be here.
Capital W?
Yes. Work with a capital W.
I see.
The work. The work that is, there's a lot of sacrifice to be here. Mm-hmm. It is sort of a calling. Let's say it's mm-hmm. a calling work. So the connection between that work and the small W work, which is all the components that are fit into survival, which range from eating and having stability in your life to the systems as the lens gets bigger, to the systems of that are interconnected in which we live. So it's just an ongoing, and I think that this work on the relationship between arts, culture, and commenting is very much the same. It's seeing that each person has a source, whether they're an artist or an individual, and that there's a relationship between that source and the choices they make to live their lives and how they make their lives, and then how those things affect the larger frameworks within which we live.
Well, it seems that so much of what your work's about is trying to reintegrate a wholeness in your lives and indeed drawing your artistic performance from the whole person in a way that is not necessarily the case, at least in acting.
We produce a journey for each individual that is participating here, a journey of self-discovery, which then we hope that would be present at the time of delivering a performance with the audience, and the audience starts the journey of self-discovery. Now, when we started this, and we were trying to do this kind of like excellence, we had this idea of excellence, we thought, well, the only way to do this is to guarantee for an artist to have the possibility to do it over years, because if you cannot do it over years, and you're waiting tables, and you're going from one gig to another, you're not focusing on the techniques and the journey of, and the work with capital W. You're focusing on trying to get the money. The more we see companies adopt this model of production that is 4 weeks rehearsal, 4 weeks performance, and then move on to the next thing to get the audience buying tickets, the less the art happens. You are diluting the art. So when we proposed that we needed to go to the old, ancient, archaic models of fixed company, a stable, what it was called, the stable companies, like you have in the symphonies, right?
So you must be regarded as really quaint or backward or archaic by much of the mainstream art world and foundation world, in the sense that you're reintegrating things that people don't think are possible or functional.
We played the role of the outsider, and in some ways it was very frustrating and difficult to communicate ourselves and not to be put in this box that is of archaic or something old or backwards or rural or anything like that. Definitely not in the sort of high art realm of the visual art world. But over that made us even more resilient. It made, I think, our vision clearer. And now it's led to all these manifestations where now we're seen as leaders in our field. And art and survival is just making sure that we are leading the field through our values.
Well, tell me a little bit about the field, so to speak, because I know that you're involved, have relationships with many artistic communities around the country who have a kinship with the way you approach it, even though they might have a different way of operating or different venues and audiences. Talk to me a little bit about some of those different artistic communities who really don't register on some of the national mind maps about art, but in fact are doing some rather serious and fascinating art themselves.
Well, we're part of a consortium of what we call training-based and place-based theater, which is maybe one place to look for some of these alternative models. It includes groups like the Hinterlands in Detroit. They're working in a neighborhood, sort of reimagining a neighborhood with other artists and with community members that also, while at the same time, creating a laboratory for their art form, their mm-hmm. theater, which is also very physical and of very high quality. And they're part of a reimagining of how their neighborhood and how this community in Detroit can become resilient. I would add to that Mondo Bizarro in New Orleans, who also is creating a space that is a collectively shared space with other artists in New Orleans, Again, these are companies that are working in a laboratory ensemble fashion that already does not function in a market setting. Long-term research of a group is not rewarded.
Can barely survive.
Exactly. But what's coming out of these researches are alternative models that lean heavily into their research and rigor for their art, as well as equally so into their relationships with their communities and sort of methods of survival that come out of it that are based in sharing and exchange and understanding and cooperation. And our groups, among others, are now starting to find ways to share resources, share best practices, as well as subvert the traditional presenting model, the market-driven presenting model for touring, where we now produce each other and bring each other to places.
So you're starting to federate in a way. But tell me, let me ask a hard question. Why is this more than just an interesting marginal activity in the larger art world? Why is this important to American society, or how does it contribute to reimagining our getting beyond our societal dilemmas and finding new solutions?
I think that transforming and altering, and also somehow testing and proving that other ways of production are possible within, even within the capitalist society we live in, or the market-driven society we live in, there are benefits in terms of health, not just of the artists, but the health of the communities. There are benefits in terms of development and depth and consistency of the artistic work.
A different kind of experience.
Yes. And they're part of a life that is not contemplated by the market necessarily, but it exists. And this, I'm talking even from thinkers that are market-driven thinkers like Peter Drucker. You know, he believed that a third of the life of an industrial society is, more than a third actually, is filled with all of these activities.
Well, in some ways, not only showing that there's a non-market alternative, but one that connects more deeply and elementally with what it means to be human at a time when all of that's been objectified into market forms, a la Disney.
As we are reaffirming that these values are possible, that you can do. What you need to do is, so the transformation that needs to happen is the consideration of how these things circulate. How do we exchange is the important thing. How do we change and exchange the exchanges? That's then, you see, this experience is doable, is viable, because it's supported, like in the old days, is supported by the community. It's like community-supported agriculture. This is community-supported theater.
So getting beyond, say, producer, consumer, and the standard market identities and relationships, you're showing that a whole new form of collaboration can make these things go.
Right, which takes a lot of work. And this is where the trap is. You know, the path of least resistance here would not work. You need to really work with to see what are all the elements that are necessary and how am I going to provide for them. Electricity, heating, vehicles to transport people, food, health, education for the kids, because it's alive. So you need to contemplate all that in the production system. You need to create an aesthetic of that. And by aesthetic, I'm not talking about beauty. I'm sorry, I need to make this very clear. For people to understand what I mean by aesthetic, I want to point out what it is the opposite of aesthetic. The opposite of aesthetic is anesthetic. So aesthetic is feelings. So there is a feeling of how we produce. We are feeling it like we feel pain, cold, heat, hunger. We feel it's connected to our instincts. There is aesthetic of this production. And then we produce something aesthetic because of that.
Wow. Well, I mean, you guys, for me, are really on the frontier of commenting precisely because of your kind of fearless exploration of how feeling is the work, is the engine for so much of what the Commons does and how this can take so many really enlivening forms.
That may have been a perfect place to end.
I think that might be a perfect place to end. Well, thank you both for joining me for this, the inaugural podcast, and I hope to hear more from you in the future.